I've been asked to say a few words this morning on the subject of why we should read the suttas. And honestly, I think that's a bit of a strange question. Why should we read the suttas? The Buddha was the wisest and best person who's ever lived on this planet. That's why. Do you need any other reason? Yeah? Why? What you should really be asking is, why are you all here listening to me? I'm not the wisest and best person who's ever lived on the planet. In fact, I'm not even in the top 10. I'm probably not even the wisest and best person in this room. I just happen to be the one that they put up here and put a microphone in front of. I'm sure there's a lot of other people here who have much more wisdom than I do. So why are you listening to me? I don't know. Anyway, that's where we are, so we've got to deal with it. But seriously, yeah? This is the Buddha we're talking about. Yeah? The big B. Right? Everybody knows the Buddha is full of wisdom, right? Even people who are not Buddhists know that. Yeah? Everybody in the world, everywhere you go in the world, the word Buddha is like a synonym for wisdom. People know he's this great sage, this great realized master. When we look at the suttas, what we call the suttas are this really extraordinary literature. You think about it. People sometimes say, like, you know, someone was saying just before this, oh, we try to read the suttas, but there's so many of them. We can't. Well, that's not a problem. It means you're not going to run out anytime soon. But ask yourself the question, why are there so many? Right? And we often, I think, as Buddhists, we don't really reflect on how extraordinary it is that we have this collection of teachings. And we look back in the ancient world and we ask, you know, if we look around the world, how many people from 2,500 years ago do we have the words and the teachings of, right? How many people? The answer is very, very few. Yeah? There's a few of the Greek philosophers, but even then, you know, there's only a handful, really, that we have any teachings of any substance. Even the famous philosophers like Pythagoras and so on, we don't actually have any of their teachings. Yeah? So you have some things of Socrates and Aristotle and a few later ones, but very few, just a few people, that's it. And then, you know, look all through the ancient world, in China, yeah, how much do you have? Well, there's the Confucius texts and a few other things, but very, very few. The same thing in ancient India, a few people who were regarded as important enough to record their words, but none of them where their words were recorded in such quantity as the words of the Buddha. So why is that? Yeah. Was it because the monks were just bored? Right? They didn't have anything better to do. We might as well make up a few more suttas. We don't have enough. I don't think so. There has to be something to explain. You know, it takes incredible energy to do that. Right? It doesn't just happen. How do you actually record so many thousands and thousands and thousands of words? How do you collate it? How do you put it together? How do you maintain it? It takes time and effort and energy. Yeah? Why did people think that it was worth doing that? Yeah? Obviously, they thought that these words were special, that they had a uniqueness to them, that there was a power and a strength to them. They believed that these words, the words that the Buddha taught, were the key. Yeah? The key to enlightenment itself. The key to unlocking the mysteries. The key to finding an ending of suffering. Yeah? And when you believe that you're possession of something which is so precious and so amazing, yeah? And this is what gave that that community, the early community Buddhists, that energy to put together these suttas. And what we find when we read the suttas is we find that the suttas are very much a living document. Suttas are not dry textbooks, and the suttas are not tame. Right? The suttas are not tame. The suttas are challenging. Right? The suttas are confronting. The suttas are difficult sometimes. And so they should be. Right? Life is not tame. Yeah? Anybody who tries to tell you that, you know, that they can, you know, once you get these teachings and you organize them and you categorize them and you put them in an encyclopedia or you put them on Wikipedia or something like that. Wikipedia is great to look things up, but it's not very inspiring, is it? Right? What we see with the suttas is we see the record of that inspiration of the Dhamma as it actually appears. We see the record of the Buddha actually talking to people. Imagine what that was like. Right? Imagine what it was like to actually be teaching, speaking to the Buddha, asking him questions. Right? It must have been such an extraordinary experience. Imagine if the Buddha came into this room right now. Maybe he did. We just didn't recognize him. Imagine how you'd feel if we were sitting here. We were just reading one of the suttas earlier where the Buddha came along and a group of the monks were discussing and the Buddha waited outside while they were talking the Dhamma. Yeah? And when he heard that they'd finished talking, he sort of coughed and knocked on the door and came in. The Buddha was very polite. Imagine if we were sitting here and then we realized the Buddha was just waiting outside that door. First of all, you'd feel very embarrassed, wouldn't you? The Buddha made the Buddha wait. Oh my goodness, how much bad karma is that? Yeah. But imagine that thrill you'd have, that how amazing it would be. And so when we read the suttas, you know, we catch a glimpse of that. Of course, you know, so much has been lost and so much has gone. We are at a distance of 2,500 years, distance of time and place. We live in a very different culture. We live in a very different world. And things will never be the same as they were then. But the experience of the people isn't all that different. Yeah? The social constructs and all of those things are different. But when we see the stories of the sufferings that people go through, the losses that they experience, the confusion that they feel, then these things we can relate to. These are people, these are stories of people in their struggles through life, and they're stories of them looking for some kind of solution, looking for a word. Where can I find one word that might bring peace to my heart? Yeah? There's one of my favorite suttas is the Samanyapala Sutta, Digha Nikaya number 2, and it gives the story of King Ajatasattu. And here you have this great king who's ascended to his throne by committing a terrible crime. He killed his own father so he could gain the throne. And the sutta opens with him on the roof of his palace in a beautiful moonlit night. And he says, oh, it's so wonderful this moonlit night, it's so auspicious, it's so marvelous this moonlit night. If only on this moonlit night I could find one ascetic, one philosopher, who could bring peace to my heart. Yeah? And that's such a poignant moment, yeah, to think of this. This is a king. Yeah? This is the greatest power in the land. He has all the wealth. He has everything that he's wanted. He's got there ruthlessly. Yeah? Now he has it all, and it's time to stop. And then he realizes that all he's missing is all that really matters. Yeah? And he was fortunate. King Ajatasattu was fortunate. He could go and see the Buddha. Yeah? And the Buddha could bring peace to his heart. We also are very fortunate. Yeah? We can hear the Dhamma. We can access the Dhamma in ways today that were simply impossible in the past. At the moment, one of my main jobs I work on the website Sutta Central. And one of the things that we're trying to do with Sutta Central is to bring the suttas to everybody in the world. For the first time, we can do this. And my aim is to bring the suttas, not just to bring the suttas to everybody in the world, but to bring them to the world in the best possible way. Yeah, so often when we come to Buddhism and we look at the things, when people do things on a volunteer basis and a part-time basis, it's all a bit shoddy. Websites are built, you know, by somebody on the weekend who doesn't really know how to build websites, and they do the best they can with the time they have. But it's all a bit half-hearted sometimes. So when I came to building this site, I thought, no, we're not going to do it like that. We're going to do everything we can to make every detail as good as we can possibly do it. And we're going to strive not just to present the suttas in, we have now 20 languages on Sutta Central, right? 20 languages. Within a few months we'll have 30 languages. So we'll not only have each of these languages, but we'll present each one in the best possible way for the best experience for everybody in the world. Currently, about 4 billion people in the world have access to the internet. No? So that means 4 billion people can read the suttas. Not quite, because we don't have all the languages yet. Think about this. Think how extraordinary this moment is in history. Go back 200 years. 200 years ago, who could read the suttas? No? A few monks, basically. Yeah, maybe a few hundred people in the whole world. Maybe a few thousand if you're lucky. Yeah. Suttas were on palm leaf manuscripts. Yeah. Those manuscripts were rarely used for teaching and so on. Most people would use secondary and tertiary sources for teaching and things. So maybe a few hundred, maybe a few thousand at most, monks would have had access to the teachings, the real teachings. So that's it. 100 years ago, they published the suttas as books. Okay. So they became much more widespread. They gradually began to do translations, right? They became more widespread. So a few tens of thousands, maybe a few hundreds of thousands of people had access to them. When they began the internet, they began to put the suttas out and people began translating. These days, I'm in contact with people who are translating suttas in all kinds of languages. Polish, Norwegian, Russian, Hindi, Sinhala, Thai, Indonesian, Korean, Vietnamese, yeah? People all around the world are taking these suttas and they're translating and they're putting them into their own language. This is what the Buddha said we should do, right? The Buddha said, you don't have to learn any special languages to learn the suttas. You should teach the Dhamma in your own language, yeah? So this is what we're doing today, yeah? Bring the Dhamma to their own language so that every person in the world can read the suttas. And do you know how much that's needed? My goodness. You go around the world and honestly, there's so little wisdom, you know? And so many times, so many places, people are caught up in violence and these cycles of violence and anger and hatred and aggression, and they don't know another way. And they think that that way is right. They think that they're right to hate, yeah? And they think that if they hate enough and they kill enough, that somehow they'll get what they want, yeah? And there are so many people in the world who think like that, and there are so many people in the world who think that they can get what they want by consuming, yeah? By having, yeah? By having more things. I can go shopping and I can find happiness. Yeah. I don't know if you're one of the English philosopher, quite famous, done a number of TV programs. His name Alan Botton. I can't remember his name. Alan Botton. Anyway, and he did this program, and one of the things they did was this thing on consumerism. And so they put he remarked that in the old days in ancient Greece, the philosopher Epicurus used to have a sign that was above the marketplace, And the sign said, essentially said something like moderation in all things, something like that. And so that when you came to the market, you could see that there was this message saying, you know, moderation is good. So we say, well, we don't really have that these days. Whenever we go shopping, all you see is excess. Huh? More is good. So he thought, okay, we'll see if we can bring back that tradition. So they made a billboard, right, to put in a shopping center. And the billboard, he commissioned an advertising company to do the campaign. And the billboard they came up with was a picture, beautiful picture, of an English manor home, beautiful, lovely estate home with a lovely Jaguar sports car parked in the driveway. Yeah, everything looking so nice. And then just a little sign, it had an asterisk on the bottom, and it said, happiness not included. Yeah, happiness not included. What a wonderful message, yeah? Yeah? Happiness not included. He's not saying that you can't have those things. He's not saying that it's wrong to have a nice car or something. But don't imagine that that's going to make you happy. Yeah? Right? I mean, this is what happens, right? You save up, you do all these things, you buy a nice new car, you think, wow, you feel so proud, you drive along, you think, oh, I'm really good because I've got my new car, everybody's looking at you. Nobody cares. Right? And after you've driven it for half an hour, it's like, oh yeah, I've got to pick the kids up from school, I've got to go shopping, oh, I've got to find a parking spot. And then your car is just a hassle like any other car. Yeah. So that's a really good idea, isn't it? Why don't we do more things like that, more billboards? Yeah, that would be a good thing BF can do, can sponsor some billboards in the shopping centres, yeah? Something like that, yeah? Yeah? Try to get that message out. Contentment, it's enough. We don't have to have so many things, you know. And this again is one of the great things we find in the suttas, you know. It says just as this lovely image, it says just like when a bird, it flies, it just takes its wings with it. Its wings are its only burden. And so the same way when a monk wanders, then he takes his bowl and his robe and his laptop. It didn't. I just put that bit in there to justify the fact that I've got a laptop. But anyway. And so little things that you need, you know. I didn't bring it today, but many of you have seen, you know, carry when I travel, I just carry my monk's bag with me, you know. Last year I did teachings in Europe, I arrived in Vienna, and they picked me up from the airport, and I had my bag, and they said, oh, you know, do you have any luggage? Right? I said, that's it. And they say, wow, you travel with just that bag, that's really amazing. I said, no, you don't understand. This bag isn't what I travel with. This bag is everything that I own. Right? Right? Everything is in this bag. And if I can't fit it in this bag, I just leave it behind. Yeah? That's it. Yeah? Here I am, 48 years of age, and that's all I've got to show for it. Yeah? Right? And you can go through life, and you go, look, think about what you have in your home. Right? You know, I go to people's homes sometimes, and sometimes I remember one time I went to this, you know, they went to this garage, and they open up and they show you this garage, and this guy's kind of a shame faced because he's got this big, huge double garage packed to the brim with boxes of things, and he says, you know, we moved into this house 10 years ago and we haven't unpacked these boxes. Right? And you do so many things. We travel and we have this burden. Actually, you can leave all those things behind. And one of the, you know, it's one of the lovely things that you see in the suttas is it just gives you this example, you know, that actually it is possible. It is possible to live a life where you're not really worried about getting lots of things. You can live a life where simplicity actually is normal and good. Yeah? And you don't have to feel that, you know, you have to show off and get all the status symbols and all these kinds of things. They're all just empty anyway. They're just empty symbols. Who cares? Leave all those things behind. Yeah. So when we look at the suttas and we read what the suttas contain, then they contain this kind of vast ocean of wisdom. So many different contexts, so many different situations that the Buddha was in. I remember when I first started reading the suttas, the first few suttas I read, I mean, obviously there are a lot of things that I didn't understand, a lot of things that I was, you know, confused about or whatever. But also one of the things that I when I first started reading the suttas, I had this feeling a little bit of disappointment. I felt that in some ways they were a bit ordinary. I don't know what I expected. But then as you read more and more, you realize that it's the ordinariness of things which is sometimes the most extraordinary. It's the way that the way that the Buddha talks and the way that he communicates. It's not that there's any one thing which is so amazing, but it's that he's so consistent all the time. Every person he comes in contact with, he'll always respond to them with compassion. He'll always respond to them with wisdom. He will always address the issue which is actually before them. He's never demeaning. He's never, putting people down unless they really need it. Not to say he didn't have a sense of humor. He did. But it was a gentle sense of humor. And, for example, one Brahmin came to him, was very stuck up and very proud. And he announced to the Buddha, he said, my view is this, I nothing whatsoever is agreeable to me. Right? In other words, he's not attached to anything, he doesn't have any likes. And the Buddha says, well, what about your view? Is that agreeable to you? Right? So there's a kind of wit that you get, there's a kind of immediate response, And, another case you had in the Vinaya, you had another case of a monk who came to see the Buddha, and this monk had castrated himself. And he came to see the Buddha and said, the Buddha speaks in favor of cutting off the cord of craving. And here I have cut off the cord of craving. And the Buddha said, you silly man, you cut off what should have been left and left what should have been cut off. So when we come to the suttas, what we don't find a kind of a stale and digested doctrine, right? We find the Dhamma in its pure form, in its real form, as it's emerging in contact with people and in situations with life, right? And that life that the Buddha is encountering around him, and that he's expressing both his own inner life and also his encounters with others, it's a very rich one. It's very diverse. The Buddha encounters people from all walks of life. I mean, you have the corrupt tax collectors and the generals and the prostitutes and the lepers and the paupers and the kings and the ordinary people and the proud religious people, and you have the fools and the idiots, you have the little children, and you have the old people. All so many people in so many different walks of life. And the Buddha always has something to say to them which is meaningful and true and relevant and actually helps them. And so many little details that you see. For example, just think of a few things off the top of my head that you see about how the Buddha behaved. One time he went to visit the monastery, an ashram of some of the wanderers of other traditions. And when he came in, they were sitting arguing. And when they saw that the Buddha was coming, they said, oh, shh, everyone be quiet. The Buddha, he's someone who likes silence. He likes quiet, so let's just be silent when he comes. So the Buddha came up, and they said to him, oh, welcome, Buddha. Please come and sit down, and please tell us, what's your teaching? What doctrine do you teach? And the Buddha says, don't worry about that. I'm interested to hear what's your doctrine. Right? And they go, wow, that's so amazing. He said, every other monk who's come in here has tried to sell us his doctrine and tried to push his doctrine on us. And here, even when he's asked about his teaching, he says, oh, don't worry about that. Let me listen to what your doctrine is. Yeah? They said, wow, we really have to hear what his doctrine is now. Yeah? Yeah? That's like what is psychology, yeah? But that you know, there's that kind of detail. It's very you learn, you see all the how he's responding in these different circumstances, yeah? Another time he's talking to somebody from another religion. Again, I talk a lot about interfaith in this thing of talking about suttas because many of the suttas are a record of interfaith dialogue. The Buddha wasn't in a Buddhist community, right? He was in a multi-religious, diverse interfaith community, and he was constantly talking to people of all different kinds of religious persuasions. And this is one of the reasons why I make it a point in my own practice to talk to people who are not Buddhists, right? Because when you're talking to Buddhists all the time, it's very easy to get complacent. Right, and as a monk, you know, I have a very different experience of life than you guys do, right? Because you guys go and you go to your workplace or to your home or something like that, and you meet people who have different kind of backgrounds and so on. Now, if I'm a monk, I don't necessarily do that. I only stay in the temple, and only Buddhists come, and they're all nice to me, right? And you guys come and you're kind of bow down and say, oh, sadhu, 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 and give me like lots of nice food to eat and things like that. And it's very easy to get complacent with that kind of lifestyle and to think somehow I deserve it, right? You come to expect it, right? You're not bowing low enough. Down. Get down. Right? And you get conditioned with these things, yeah? And you don't realize it. I noticed this, and actually it was interesting. I talked about it with Ajahn Brahm some time ago, and we had exactly the same experience when we first came to Australia after being in Thailand. You know, we felt inside you'd sort of internalize this sense of pride, which you didn't even notice until you come to Australia, and people don't care that you're a monk, right? And they just treat you like an ordinary person, yeah? And then you feel this sort of catch inside. Oh, I'm a monk. You shouldn't talk to me like that. And then you realize, hang on, what's that? Yeah. When Ajahn Chah visited England, he was walking through the streets of London, and it's like England in the 70s, and these punks come up to him and sort of like this, and Ajahn Chah just kind of laughed and kept walking and stuff, and then afterwards. You know, people apologize. Oh, sorry about that behavior. And Ajahn Chah said, no, he said, I'm going to have to invite all my Ajahns to come to England. Because you see those different situations and so on, and that's where you learn, and that's where you see what your own reactions are. Yeah. So, you know, a few years ago, I decided to go on a trip. We went to America and we traveled across the south of America. Actually, I got invited to a conference in Atlanta on a religious academic conference, American Association of Religions. And then I was invited to visit Bhikkhuni Monastery in San Francisco, right? And so it was on the other side of the country. I thought, well, how am I getting from one place to the other? We can fly, but that'd be boring. So why don't we drive? So that's what we did. So we drove from Atlanta to San Francisco, to Louisiana and Arkansas and so on. And I thought, oh, you know, experience the Deep South, right? And this is like the heartland of fundamentalism in America, you know? And I can go through all these places as a Buddhist monk and see what happens, yeah? So yeah, you have all these very interesting experiences, yeah? And I remember once we were buying a few supplies at the Walmart in New Orleans, yeah? And this woman behind the counter, she's like, wow, she's never seen a Buddhist monk before. And she's like, oh, is it like a skirt that you're wearing? I was with this Sri Lankan guppy, and he said to her, you know, you're going to go home tonight and tell all your friends that you saw a Buddhist monk at work today, aren't you? And she said, yeah, you're right, that's what I'm going to do. And one time we were walking along the pier, also in New Orleans. We were just going for a walk after lunch and just walking down by the wharf. And there's these guys hanging out on the pier, right? And they're all kind of, you know, safety pins through various bodily organs and tats and stuff. And they're hanging out drinking beer at midday on the pier and stuff. And we walk past them, and one of them says, you know, oi or something. And I said, yeah. And he says, you know, you're a Buddhist monk? I said, yes. And he said, meditation has changed my life. So
So I don't know what it was like beforehand, but anyway, that's anyway, that's great. You know, and so we had a really nice conversation. So, you know, he's just a young kid. He's searching for his whatever, you know, traveling across America. So anyway, so this is, again, this is one of the things that I like we find in the suttas. There's like this freshness to it, right? With the, you know, if you look in the Buddhist tradition, there are so many things that, so many things. See, any teaching, anything that you say, right? You say it once when it first happens. There's a vitality to it. There's a spark to it, right? The second time, the third time, then it doesn't keep that same spark, right? And this is one of the reasons, like when in our tradition, when we give Dhamma talks, we don't like give kind of prepared talks and things like that. We like to keep that spark to it, a bit of spontaneity, take a few risks. But the problem is, you know, once you have the suttas and once you codify the Dhamma, you know, you very rapidly lose that spark to things, and you have to sort of revitalize it. Right? So I'll just give you one example. There's a Mahayana sutta called the Vimalakirti Nidesa. And as part of that, the Bodhisattva Vimalakirti puts out the word that he's sick. He's not really sick, but it's just a skillful means, okay? And all of the monks are informed about this, and then they say, who's going to go and ask Vimalakirti whether he is, how he's feeling, okay? And everybody knows that Vimalakirti is such a wise bodhisattva that none of the monks is game to go and ask him how he's feeling, right? So, oh, no, I couldn't do that, yeah? Because they know that there's something. Eventually, Sariputta is the one who accepts. He says, okay, I can go and do that. So anyway, so they go and they... this is a very funny sutra. It's very entertaining in many ways. Vimalakirti turns Sariputta into a woman and all of these kinds of things. Right? But anyway, when they arrive at his house, he knocks at the door. Right? And Vimalakirti says, there's no one home. Right? So this is a Buddhist knock-knock joke. Yeah? It's the world's first knock-knock joke. Okay? Huh? Knock, knock, who's there? Nobody's home. What do you mean there's nobody home? I can hear your voice, but there's no one here, right? So, of course, this is a play on the whole idea of not-self and emptiness and so on, right? And you see, by that time in the Buddhist tradition, right, this is already a long time ago, right? But already the teaching on not-self had become so well-known that you had to make a joke out of it, right? To turn it into, and we do that all the time, don't we? Like something happens and you say, oh, it's suffering, and everyone has a good laugh, or oh, it's impermanent or something. And so actually this is the way that those teach. You can see that teaching has already become old by that time, right? And so it has to be rephrased and put into a new way, revitalized for another generation. Yeah? And this is what we have to keep on doing. We have to keep on keeping things fresh. And so when we're reading the Dhamma, we're going back to the source, when these things were heard for the first time, right? And the Buddha teaches this is suffering. And it wasn't just a cliche. It wasn't just a platitude, right? It was a revelation, right? To actually be able to acknowledge that actually our life is full of suffering, and it's okay to acknowledge that. It's okay to understand that. And when they first heard this, people who first heard this were completely transformed, yeah? And now we hear it and we're like, oh yeah, whatever, Four Noble Truths, you know. So you keep on coming back to the suttas, and you keep on engaging with what's that actual spark? What's that source? What's the thing that made that whole Buddhism come alive? Now, of course, we can never be there. We can never capture that 100%. Right? But at least we can get something. We can get that echo of that. And it reminds us, you know, we're reading the suttas. It reminds us again and again, you know, the Buddha is saying, Jayata bhikkhave, ma pamadatta, ma vo paccha viparisarata. Practice jhanas, monks. Don't be negligent. Don't regret it later. Ayango amhakan anusasananti. This is my instruction to you. This is what I've left behind. Yeah? So there's not like this. Some people think that there's a kind of contradiction between studying the Dhamma and practicing the Dhamma. But it is not the case. The study and the Dhamma go hand in hand with the practice of the Dhamma. The suttas are talking about meditation all the way through.
Yeah? And who is there that's a better guide to meditation than the Buddha? Yeah? You know, a few years ago, I'm teaching meditation all the time, and so you're teaching different people about meditation. And a few years ago, I began to notice this kind of way that people talk about meditation, and to realize that there was something wrong with it. And when people talk about meditation, they, you know, for example, if we talk about breath meditation, we talk about watching the breath, right? That's what you say, don't you? I'm going to watch the breath, or I'm going to focus on the breath, or something like that. That's wrong. You shouldn't focus on your breath. You shouldn't watch your breath. This is a very problematic way of thinking about meditation. And I was thinking, how did the Buddha talk about meditation? He never said that. There's nothing in the Pali that says watch your breath or anything even vaguely similar. What the Pali says is so sato va asasati sato passasati. Mindful one breathes in, mindful one breathes out. Yeah? It's actually quite a different way of approaching meditation. Like, if I'm going to watch my breath, that means that I assume that my breath is something out here. Right? I'm in here, and I am going to watch my breath. Breath is something I own. Like, I own this water bottle. It's an object, and I'm separate from that object, and I have to make myself watch it, because I could be watching something else. Right? And so then you get all this tension, you get all this distraction, and you feel like all these thoughts are coming in. People say, I've tried to watch my breath, but then all these thoughts come in, right? No, thoughts don't come in, right? You do the thoughts, right? Thoughts are something that you are doing. They're not something that happened to you, right? You're not the victim of your thoughts, yeah? You are the originator of your thoughts, right? But because we've objectified everything, we somehow think that we don't own our thoughts. We think that thoughts are a problem. Yeah? So it's a whole way of thinking about meditation that we've been programmed to because of the use of language and the way that meditation has been described. Yeah? And when I was thinking about this, it's very problematic. The more that you go into it, the more you realize it's very problematic. And I was hearing these descriptions of meditation again and again and again from people. And I was struggling to find a new way of talking about meditation that wasn't going to create these problems. And I realized, who better to look to than the Buddha? What am I doing trying to figure out this? Look, how did the Buddha talk about meditation? So sato va asasati, sato passasati. Mindful one breathes in, mindful one breathes out. Right? So your breathing is not something that you watch. It's not an object that you observe, right? We use this word meditation objects. You don't find that in the suttas, right? There's no parallel to the idea of a meditation object in the suttas. You're just breathing, right? It's something that you're doing. It's a behavior. Yeah? You're just doing what you do ordinarily, but you do it with that quality of mindfulness. That's all. That's all that breath meditation is. Right? If you want to get started in breath meditation, you don't do anything. Yeah? You're breathing already. Yeah? Most of us, anyway. Right? You're breathing already. You don't have to do anything. Meditation isn't about doing anything, but it's just about being mindful with what you're doing. Yeah? And that's a very different way of thinking about meditation and approaching meditation. And it's a way that has immediate practical benefits. You try it. You go away and you try doing it. Think, okay, I'm not going to watch my breath. I'm not going to focus on my breath. I'm not going to concentrate on my breath. I'm not going to sit there and try to stop thinking. Okay? I'm just going to breathe. Yeah? And I'll breathe with mindfulness. Yeah? It's a very beautiful way to think about meditation and to approach it. So again, this is the kind of thing that we find when we look at the suttas. We keep on coming back, and when we see issues and problems around us, yeah? So many times things in the world, things in a family, things in your meditation, problems in Buddhism and so on. And then you come back and you look, what is it that the Buddha said? Yeah? I mean, just another example is with the question of bhikkhuni ordination. Yeah? We're looking at the ordination of women and so on, and we're like, you know, what do we do with this? What's the right thing to do? Yeah? And so we go back and we look, well, what did the Buddha say? Yeah? What do the suttas say? What does the Vinaya say? And we use that, and that informs us, and it enables us to be able to regenerate and revitalize our Buddhist tradition. Yeah? Because a tradition is not a fixed thing that you hang on to. Right? And this is one of the most destructive ideas that we have in modern Buddhism. We have this idea that we have a Buddhist tradition which we have to hold on to, right? There's no such thing as a Buddhist tradition. All there is things that Buddhists have done in the past, right? That's all. That's what we call our tradition. And if Buddhists have done something in the past, we say that was our tradition. But actually, Buddhists have done all different kinds of things in the past. So what one of those is your tradition? Yeah? Usually you find that if you look, what you think is your timeless ancient Buddhist tradition is often something which was only a few generations old, maybe only a few years old. Yeah? And so we get trapped into this idea that somehow things have always been this way and they always have to be that way. Whereas in fact, if we look at what that tradition was, right, what those people were doing, what the people who made our traditions were not, they weren't simply, you know, mechanically copying over a tradition, right? They were actually asking themselves the question, how do I practice Dhamma in the here and now, right? And then that was the tradition. What emerged was their response to that. So to me, the Buddhist tradition is not the tradition that we have these fixed things that we have to have and believe and do and so on. The tradition of Buddhism is to ask the question, how do we take those teachings, that Dhamma which is taught by the Buddha, and how do we apply that and live with that and make that relevant in our context and our time? That's the question which every generation of Buddhists in the past has asked themselves, yeah? And which we too are asking ourselves. And that's our tradition. Yeah? The tradition of inquiry, the tradition of respect for the teachings of the Dhamma, yeah? And the tradition of an understanding that Dhamma has no purpose unless it's meaningful. Yeah? We don't just keeping these scriptures because they're old scriptures, right? I mean, linguists or historians or something might do that, right? They might think it's valuable because it's a historical document or something. But we don't think, that's not the reason why we're interested in it. We're interested in it because we think it's a living inspiration. And so that when we know the suttas, we can keep on coming back to them. We can keep on asking them questions. Right? And because we keep on having new questions to ask, right, new contexts, then we'll keep getting new meaning out of it. We'll keep spotting things. You know, whenever I come to the suttas, I always will spot and see things that maybe I hadn't noticed before. You know, and sometimes it's the very simple things. I was just mentioning the other day to the class, one of the things that really struck me some time ago was this verb you find in the suttas, upasankamati. And this is one of the most common words that we find throughout all the suttas. We usually translate it as approaches, right? But the literal Pali meaning, upa means close, sang means together, and kamati means to go, right? So this is the word that's used to describe when people would go and see the Buddha, yeah? So they would upasankamati, they would go up close to where the Buddha was, yeah? And it suddenly struck me that isn't that a kind of a beautiful thing? Before it was just a verb, I'd never thought about it before. But just the idea that the Buddha could be there, and he's the kind of person who you can go up close to, yeah? You can just go up to him and ask him a question. Yeah? He's not some remote, forbidding figure, right? He's not, you know, you don't have to be scared of the Buddha. Yeah? You don't have to worry if you ask him a question. Yeah? And so there's that warmth and that approachability that the Buddha had, I think, and I think which you find throughout the suttas. So you can, you know, you treat it like that, like a mentor and a friend and a teacher that you can go up to and you can ask and you can find advice and help at those times that we need it. Because we all need some help from time to time. And if we can do that and we can learn something about how the suttas work, about what's there, then we become much more self-reliant, okay? Then you don't have to bother me so much, okay? I can have a much more peaceful life. This is the real reason why we teach the suttas, yeah? Okay? And you've got problems, you can go... Actually, it doesn't really work like that when you teach people the suttas and then they come to you and ask about all the sutta questions. So anyway, so that's that. But you know what I mean, right? So Buddhism... The purpose of the Dhamma, right? And this again, what it says in the suttas, dhamma saranang, atta saranang viharata bhikkhave, ananya saranang. Yeah? So have the dhamma as your refuge, yourself as your refuge, no other refuge. Yeah? So even though, you know, you can come to the monks and the teachers and the nuns and we can give you advice and guidance and things, but ultimately you have to know for yourself. I'm not going to tell you what's right and what's wrong. I can be very annoying like that. And people sometimes come up to me and they ask, what should I do? And I don't tell them what they should do. It's not my job to run your life for you. Okay? So what I try to do when people have problems is I try to kind of reflect on it with the Dhamma and give people the opportunity to make their own minds up. Yeah? It's like I said, it can be very annoying, but that's the way it goes. Yeah? So when we study the suttas and we get the ability, the familiarity with it, and it takes a bit of time, right? But you don't have to do it all at once, yeah? So don't think of the suttas as being this sort of great, you know, thing you have to finish and this great big work. You think of the suttas as being like a friend who you can, you can keep by your side and refer to from time to time, yeah? And get some wisdom from time to time, you know? And even if you only read like one sutta a week or something like that, you just keep that with you for the rest of your life, yeah? One sutta a week, and then you're fine for a year or 2 years or 3 years or 10 years or 20 years. Actually, you've got a good knowledge of the suttas and you know what's in them and so on, yeah? And you've got that wisdom and you can always go back there if you need to, yeah? So don't think of it as something you have to sort of struggle and try really hard. You know, people say, oh, there's so many suttas and the book of suttas are so long and things like that. Well, you've all read Harry Potter, right? I mean, that's pretty long, right? The suttas aren't longer than the whole Harry Potter series. So if you can read Harry Potter, then why can't you read the suttas? Yeah. So again, you know, don't think of it, you know, suttas are something which has, you know, I mean, just give you an example of how I studied the suttas. You know, I mean, I have a reputation of being somebody, you know, somewhat of a scholarly monk and things like that. Most people don't realize, you know, I learnt the suttas by mostly reading one sutta a day, or sometimes even just reading one short group of suttas over like a rains retreat or something like that. And, you know, so what I would do is I would, you know, I was living in the monasteries or the retreat centres, and you just read one sutta during the day and then just meditate. Yeah? And that's all. It wasn't like you're sort of spending hours and hours and hours every day studying the suttas. It's just one a day. Yeah? It only takes 20 minutes, something like that. But because you're doing a lot of meditation and a lot of reflection and so on, it stays with you. And so I, you know, even though I have a very bad memory for, like, you know, everyday things, right? And when people like Beta and so on try to organize me, they will confirm that I can't remember when am I supposed to give this class and all of these kinds of stuff, whatever. But the suttas, you know, I'll remember things that I read 20 years ago and it'll just come into my mind very fresh, yeah? So it's not about how much you read, but you give yourself the space. You do a bit of meditation and your mind is clear. You read a little bit of the suttas, okay? And then you let it sink in. And then when you let it sink in like that, the wisdom will sink in and will come to you when you need it. Yeah? Yeah? So it's not about how much you read, but it's about the quality. So I think we're probably running short of time. Yep.
Right. And can we do a question on...
Sure. Questions?
Yeah, maybe we open the floor for just one question.
And remember also the suttas are records of Q&A sessions. Almost all the suttas are Q&A, yeah? Especially any longer sessions, yeah? So this is a noble Buddhist tradition, is asking lots of questions. Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Venerable Manti Sujata, for the insightful talk about the suttas. Okay, this question I'm going to ask you is not a fair question for you, I think. May not be a fair question, but I'll ask it anyway.
Go on.
You spoke a lot about the suttas and how refreshing and how enlightening, how it's been documented. A pastor who stands before his congregation or a priest will say exactly or similar things about the Bible, the parables of Jesus and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So what I would like you to do is ask you to comment, contrast these two without saying which one is better, which one is good, whether God is...
Oh, the suttas are better.
Sadhu, sadhu.
But you're true, but it's right, and that pastor is quite correct. Okay, now there are, and this is actually some of those qualities I mentioned of the suttas are qualities that you find of all the great spiritual literature, and that's why it is great spiritual literature. And yes, in the Bible you find a lot of those similar qualities. Like there's a freshness to many of the things. There's an encounter. People have some kind of transformative experience that they don't understand, yeah? And so, yes, there is that quality, similar, for example, with the Upanishads, like the pre-Buddhist Hindu scriptures. Again, you find that same kind of thing. It's like a sense of wonder and awe which you get when you sort of this encounter with this new truth. And so I think that there is that quality that all great spiritual literature has, yeah. So, look, I think the Bible has lots of fantastic things in it, and I highly recommend it. If you haven't read the Bible, you should read it. But it's not going to teach you about meditation. It's not going to teach you about a lot of the things that you find in the suttas. And the Bible, of course, is an accumulation of many different things written by different people over a long period of time. Yeah, I mean, the Old Testament was compiled in about the 5th century BC in Babylon. And it was partly written at that time and partly a collection of different texts from different times and different places. So you find very, very different kinds of things throughout the Bible. So if you want a starting point for one of the Bible books in the Old Testament, I would recommend Ecclesiastes. It's fantastic. Vanity, vanity, all is vanity. And poor old Ecclesiastes, he was really struggling with that. And the other one, which is good as a starting point, is the Gospel of Mark. Again, the Gospel of Mark has this incredible vitality to it. Everybody's rushing here and there, and everyone's so astounded by all the things that Jesus says and so on. So it definitely has that kind of quality, and you know, you can see why people find it inspiring. Yeah. So don't be kind of afraid of these things. I mean, obviously, you know, if I saw a, you know, Christian pastor, I'd expect him to say that the Bible's better, so that's fine. And we could have a nice sort of chat about what we find valuable in those scriptures. But I think it's useful to spend some time reading the scriptures of other religions as well. Yeah.
Right. So we all have mindfully listened. We all have mindfully captured in our minds.
Mm. There'll be a test afterwards. Yeah.
As well as retained in our hearts on the practice of the Dharma. I do apologize. I have to call the session to a close. With all due respect, Ajahn has his only meal and he has to eat before 1 o'clock. So if we all could also mindfully come together and rejoice in this morning's inspiring Dharma teaching by Ajahn Sujato, let us all now rejoice together. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Okay.
Okay.